This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Welcome back, everybody, to Crimes and Consequences. I'm Talia, and today's story is one that I've been working on for a long time. I've been doing a lot of research, and I found it really, really fascinating. The story today is about a brutal murder and torture of an American DEA agent, Enrique Camarena. But the story is not just about DEA agent Enrique Camarena. It's also about four American Jehovah Witnesses who knocked on the wrong door in Guadalajara and two American tourists who went to the wrong seafood restaurant in Guadalajara and a Mexican pilot who was assisting the DEA. They were all tortured and murdered by a collective group comprised of the Guadalajara cartel, the Mexican government, Mexican police and the Mexican military, and even perhaps by some other Americans.
Oh no.
To create this episode, I relied on autopsy reports, transcripts of torture sessions, court records, trial testimony, and I watched the documentary The Last Narc, and also an article called Blood on the Corn. So there you go.
Whew, a lot.
That being said, it's really important to get some background to get the full effects of this story. So I'm going to talk about Enrique Camarena. He's known as Kiki. He was born on July 26, 1947 in Mexicali, Mexico. He was one of seven children born to his parents, Dora and Daniel. When he was 9 years old, the whole family immigrated to Calexico, California. And that's in Imperial County, and it's a border town on the U.S. and Mexico border. Dora and Daniel divorced shortly after coming to the United States, and the Cameranian household was plagued by poverty. Kiki's oldest brother, Eduardo, he joined the Marines. He was sent to Vietnam, and he died in combat in 1965. The following year, another older brother of Kiki's, Ernesto, joined the Army. Kiki was still in high school at the time. He was going to Calexico High. While in 10th grade, he met and fell in love with a woman who ended up being his future wife. Her name was Geneva, known as Mika. In 1966, Kiki graduated, and he followed his brother's footsteps by joining the service after graduation. He went to the Marines. He was honorably discharged after 2 years. And then as soon as he got discharged, he went home and he married Mika. As I said, they had a beautiful relationship that lasted until his untimely and very brutal death. After the Marines, Kiki decided to start a career in law enforcement. He was a firefighter for a little bit and then a police officer. Within a year, he was working as a special agent doing undercover narcotics for Imperial County Narcotics Task Force. And he thrived at this job. Kiki was just a straight shooter. He followed the rules and he really just wanted to stop the bad guys. So I've told you a little bit about Kiki. I also have to give you a little background about the relationship of the United States and Mexico around the time of the story. The United States had been fighting a war on drugs. We all know about the war on drugs since the 1930s. For decades, there was a heroin smuggling network known as the French Connection.
Oh, okay.
I'd heard of the French Connection, but I had no idea what it was. So the French Connection was smuggling heroin and other drugs into the United States. And the U.S., with the cooperation of the Turkish and French governments, they were able to weaken the French Connection in the 1960s, and they ultimately destroyed it by the 1970s. However, as we know, once you knock out one group, another group will come in and just take over. And that's exactly what ended up happening. Mexico and Central and South American countries, they began filling the drug void. An influx of marijuana and heroin began flooding the U.S. borders again. And in 1973, to combat this problem, the U.S. created the Drug Enforcement Administration, known as the DEA. Now, Spanish-speaking agents were in high demand at the DEA, and in the 1970s in the U.S., Spanish wasn't as common as it is now. Kiki applied for the job, and he was hired as a special agent. He could speak Spanish and English very well. So he started working for the DEA office in Calexico, and this is about 1974. His sister, Myrna, she followed suit. She got hired as a secretary at the same office, and they worked together for a while. After 3 years there, he accepted a transfer to the DEA's office in Fresno, California. That's about 7 hours north. He still was doing undercover narcotics work, and he was extremely dedicated to his job. But this dedication didn't match the dedication he had to his wife. Together, they started a family, and they had three sons, Enrique Jr., Eric, and Daniel. The Mexican government worked jointly with the U.S. to help fight the war on drugs. Sort of. Wink, wink. At least on paper. The CIA helped Mexico create its own central intelligence agency, and this is important. It's called DFS. So whenever I say DFS, think of it as the CIA in Mexico. The U.S. government actually funded Mexico's DFS and trained its agents. To be able to work for the DFS as an agent, you had to be like an elite badass.
Awesome.
That's your qualification.
Elite badass.
You have to be better than everybody else. One of those kind of people. The DEA established a resident office in Guadalajara, Mexico. And in 1980, a friend of Kiki's suggested that he apply for an opening there. Guadalajara was bustling with the drug cartel. The drug cartel was forming and gaining strength, particularly in that area. Kiki saw this foreign assignment as a way to enhance his resume and climb up the DEA's ladder. He applied for the job. He spoke to Mika about it, and they decided they should move there, and he got the job. So they all moved there in 1980. They had no idea how dangerous their lives would become there. Give you a little background on the DEA. The DEA in those offices, those agents were allowed to be there because of the Mexican government. But there were rules in place. DEA agents had no law enforcement powers. And I don't know what you know about DEA. I didn't know that much about them. That's why I'm telling you this, because it all adds to the story.
Yeah, I really don't know much, so.
The DEA, they could gather intelligence on drug trafficking, but they can't make any arrests. They really aren't supposed to have guns, even. They are more like consultants for local authorities to catch the drug traffickers. They'll get the information.
Oh, and then pass it on.
And then pass it on and advise on the best way to take down the drug traffickers. Mexico allowed the DEA agents to carry guns on them during the day, but not when they were not working. In addition, there was a law known as the Mansfield Amendment, which was passed by the U.S. Congress in 1975, and that prohibited DEA agents from even being present at the scene of an arrest. So they have, like, no power, really. These rules ensured that American agents would have no other choice but to work really closely with the Mexican government something done.
That makes sense.
In Mexico, the 1960s and 1970s, opium and marijuana plantations sprouted up. They were plantations all around Mexico growing these plants. The DEA agents would fly their planes with the help of Mexican pilots, for the most part, over these areas and try to find the plantations. One of those pilots that would help them, his name was Captain Alfredo Zavala Avalares. He was a professional pilot for the Mexican Ministry of Agriculture, and he's a very important person to remember, Alfredo. Through U.S. funding, chemicals would be sprayed from helicopters and planes, and it killed all these growing crops. This proved to be really effective, but it really pissed off the drug cartel. That's when the drug traffickers really stepped up their game in paying off government officials, military personnel, and law enforcement in exchange for protection. By the time Kiki and his family moved to Guadalajara, a new Mexican president, his name was Jose Lopez Portillo, he scaled down the eradication of crops And this led to massive plantations. And do you know what massive plantations lead to? A lot of money for the drug cartel. They were getting loaded. In Guadalajara, it consisted of three very, very dangerous men. The three major drug lords were Rafael Caro Quintero, Ernesto Fonseca, and Miguel Felix. These three worked together to perfect and protect their product, which was now worth billions of dollars. They created better seeds and more secluded plantations with these really intricate watering systems. They were willing to do whatever needed to be done to ensure that their businesses thrived, including torture, dismemberment, rape, and murder. So now you've got most of the backstory. When Kiki got to Guadalajara, he worked with an informant. His name was Miguel Sanchez, quote unquote. And that led to the discovery of these new style plantations in the desert in Mexico, these big ones. Kiki helped take down a plantation he discovered. And to everyone's surprise, it was 1,000 acres. It was the largest raid they'd ever had. This plantation had hundreds of workers.
Damn.
The drug cartel felt the blow, but it didn't slow them down. Now, the aerial surveillance continued with the cooperation of Mexico. In 1983, Kiki got wind that there was this large plantation in Chihuahua at a place called the Rancho Buffalo. Have you heard of this?
No.
Oh. An informant who had personal knowledge of this plantation because he was a cook there, he told the DEA about what was going on. And when Kiki and his supervisor, Jamie, they looked at these aerial photos, because remember, I told you they do aerial surveillance. They were given aerial photos by the Mexican government. And they looked at these photos and they didn't see a plantation. But they thought, you know what? I bet these photos are old.
Sneaky.
Yeah. So Kiki and Captain Alfredo Zavala, they agreed to fly over the area and take some new photos. And when they did, they spotted a 2,500-acre marijuana plantation growing at Rancho Buffalo. It had a few thousand people working there.
Wow, it was a huge operation.
The DEA gave this information to the Mexican authorities, and the Mexican authorities had no choice but to act because they have to play the game. They have to appear to be tough on drugs.
They can't just ignore that.
They can't. So they sent in 450 Mexican soldiers who burned Rancho Buffalo to the ground. And when I say they had no other choice but to do that, I say that because many of the top Mexican military, politicians, and police were working with the cartel. And I'll get into that in a few minutes, but it's about as high up as you can possibly get. Someone must have tipped off the cartel about the raid in advance because only a handful of the thousands of workers were there. The Mexican soldiers literally lit up 2,500 acres of marijuana.
They set it on fire?
They set it on fire. You imagine that wind? That
I know.
Breeze?
I was like, did anybody make it out of there without getting a buzz?
I don't think so. This was a huge hit to the cartel, especially Rafael Caro Quintero. He owned that plantation. But as I said, Rafael, he worked with Ernesto Fonseca and Miguel Felix. And together, these three men, they wanted answers. After years of feeling invincible, they were confronted with their own vulnerability. And they were desperate to find out which DEA agent was responsible for the bust. Rafael, Ernesto, and Miguel developed a paranoia concerning DEA agents and gringos.
Oh, no.
In general. This was November of 1984, and it was a very bad time to be an American in Guadalajara. Earlier that year, a married couple named Benjamin Massarain, he was 26, and his wife Pat, they were invited to work for a wealthy family in Guadalajara. And I'm not sure exactly what they did there. But Benjamin and Pat were Jehovah Witnesses, and they thought this would be a great opportunity for them to help spread their faith. After a few months of being there, they invited some of their friends. It was a couple, Dennis and Rose Carlson from California. They invited them to visit them. Rose and Dennis were a little bit older, and they were Jehovah Witnesses too. Not long after Dennis and Rose arrived in Guadalajara, The couples began going door to door, handing out pamphlets on their religion and talking to anyone interested in learning more about it. You know how that works. On December 2nd, they knocked on the wrong person's door. The two couples went to this middle class area in what's called Chapalita. It's a neighborhood. And unbeknownst to them, they knocked on the door of drug lord Ernesto's house. One of many. These men own lots of houses, but he was there.
Oh, no.
What ended up happening to Benjamin, Pat, Dennis, and Rose was only recently really brought out for us to all learn about. Three former Mexican state police officers came forward in 2018, and they spoke with the U.S. Attorney's Office and DEA Special Agent Hector Reyes, giving their account of what happened to the four Jehovah's Witnesses. Former state police officer Jorge Godoy, Rene Lopez, and their senior sergeant, Ramon Lira, they were three of the cartel's bodyguards, and they provided a lot of info on what happens to all the Americans that I'm going to tell you about in this story. And it's very important that I say their names because they've risked their lives to tell us. Ramon, Jorge, and Rene, they didn't start out on the wrong side of the law. They joined the Mexican police to do the right thing. They were good, honest police officers. But as luck would have it, they each got formally assigned in their capacity as police officers to be bodyguards for the cartel.
The government provided bodyguards to the cartel?
Yes.
Okay.
And you don't say no.
Right. Yeah, of course.
I'm sorry, drug lords. I'm so busy. Otherwise, I'd love to guard you.
That's so bizarre.
They were originally told that they were protecting DFS officers. In fact, the three drug lords were given DFS credentials, like CIA credentials.
Wow.
But it didn't take long for Ramon, Jorge, and Rene to learn the truth. The corruption ran so deep. To give you an idea of how deep it was, the state that Guadalajara is in is called Jalisco. The governor of Jalisco, his daughter was dating Rafael Caro Quintero, the kingpin.
His daughter?
His daughter.
Wow.
Her name was Sarah. But the corruption gets darker and deeper, as you shall soon see. So as I said, back to the Jehovah's Witnesses. On the morning of December 2nd, the two couples, they set out to spread the gospel. According to bodyguard / police officer Jorge, at around 9 a.m., one of the couples went up to Ernesto's door and rang his doorbell. Nobody answered the door, but Ernesto's son-in-law peeked out the window and noticed that they looked like gringos, Americans. He went back and he told Ernesto that there were some Americans at the door and maybe they're DEA agents. Ernesto orders his henchmen to get the couples. At that point, they had already started walking on the sidewalk. So Ernesto's men went outside and kidnapped them in broad daylight on the sidewalk and brought them back into the house. They were in the house and they were interrogated by Rene, the police officer / bodyguard. But he says his interrogation was very soft. He spoke to them for a while and they told him, "We are not DEA agents. We are really just Jehovah's Witnesses spreading the word." And Rene said he believed them.
That's a great, like, disguise, though, if they were, right?
I mean, I don't know. I guess.
I mean, the DEA agents say they're Jehovah's Witnesses.
You'd have to really study up on Jehovah's Witnesses.
That's true.
Ernesto wasn't having any of it, though. I told you, the paranoia is extremely high with the drug cartel. And the paranoia and hatred, it's fueled by week-long parties with drug binges. These parties, just so you know, were so extreme that people often OD'd. So they had a doctor on call for their parties. So they're always high and they're very paranoid. Dennis, Rose, Benjamin, and Pat, they were moved from Ernesto's home and brought to an apartment and they were stripped. And then they were interrogated much more roughly. After that, they were then moved to a ranch outside of Guadalajara. The henchman in charge was no other than El Chapo, otherwise known as
Joaquin Guzman.
Yes. Who, according to Ramon, Rene, and Jorge, the police officers. He had a penchant for dismemberment and blood. He enjoyed cutting and disemboweling. They witnessed it.
Psycho.
At the ranch, Rose and Pat were separated from their husbands, and they were put naked in a bedroom together in the main house. Dennis and Benjamin were bound and thrown into a horse stall. Later, the beaten men were taken into the house, and they were forced to watch Rose and Pat be gang raped in front of them. According to the article called Blood on the Corn, Dennis was a Vietnam vet, and he started fighting back. I mean, this is just horrific what he's seeing. He's trying to stop the rapes, but they just beat him into submission. There were a lot of cartel thugs there. As I said, the four were tortured, and one of the torture methods the cartel did was they placed rope between Pat and Rose's legs, and they're naked, and they got the rope up to their genital area, and they just went back and forth with the rope, sliding it, until their vaginal area was all bloody and bruised.
Have you ever had a rope burn?
Yeah.
Like, not there, I know, but...
not there, yeah.
Oh, my God. That's horrible.
In front of their husbands. At night, a crew of men arrived on the ranch, and they began digging a large hole that was going to serve as the grave for the four Americans. The next morning, after spending the previous evening being beaten, tortured, and raped, Dennis, Rose, Benjamin, and Pat were taken one by one from the house and brought to stand in front of the grave. They all separately begged for their lives, claimed their innocence, and each one was shot, and their bodies fell into the grave. And then, I don't know why, for chits and giggles, El Chapo cut their heads off, and dirt was put on top of them. In 2018, the U.S. Attorney's Office said they were considering pressing charges against El Chapo for the murder of these Americans, but thus far, no charges have been brought. But Dennis, Pat, Rose, and Benjamin, they weren't the only Americans mistaken for DEA agents by the cartel. 35-year-old John Walker, he was a journalist in the United States. He was also a former Vietnam vet, and he was twice decorated with Purple Heart for his battle wounds. He had two daughters, and he was married to a woman named Eve. Originally, he was from Minnesota, but he came down to Guadalajara by himself to gain inspiration for a murder novel he was planning on writing. On January 30th, 1985, this is only a month after the Jehovah's Witnesses were killed, and this is only 2 months after Kiki did that huge raid on Rancho Buffalo. On January 30th, John arranged to have dinner with his friend. He was 35-year-old Alberto Radelet. Alberto was a green card holder from Fort Worth, Texas, and I got this info from the court records, which differs a lot from news articles. According to the court records, Alberto was a photographer. Other places say he was a dental student studying at the University of Guadalajara. Maybe it was both. I don't know. Anyway, he was friends with John, and the two decided they were going to go have dinner together at a seafood restaurant called La Langosta Loca, the Crazy Lobster. They had no idea this restaurant was owned by Rafael Caro Quintero, and it was a favorite hotspot of the drug kings. In fact, many of the hotels and restaurants in Guadalajara were owned by the cartel, which was an open secret there. Kiki Camarena, he knew about La Langosta Loca, and he would never dare go there. He knew it was absolutely the worst place an American could go to. So these poor guys, John and Alberto, they just want to have a seafood dinner.
They just want some lobster.
Right. I want some lobster. It's around 7 o'clock and they enter the restaurant. They're greeted at the door by Jorge Godoy, the policeman who's assigned to be Ernesto's bodyguard. The Guadalajara cartel had reserved the restaurant for their own private party that night.
Oh, shit.
Ernesto, El Chapo, Rafael Caro Quintero, Javier Barba Hernandez, a couple other people, a guy named Vasquez Velasco. They're all sitting at this table, and they're scary people. And they're jacked up on coke and alcohol. You know, they're probably bad to begin with. You throw in pounds of cocaine and alcohol, and you're going to get a really bad mix. John and Alberto walked in. Jorge saw them, and he said he knew it wasn't going to end well.
Aww.
He came up to them, and he told them, "We're closed. Please leave immediately. Please leave immediately.
Take a hint, man.
John said something, I don't know, something polite. And the drug lord, Rafael Caro Quintero, he overheard John speaking and he recognized his American accent.
Oh, shit.
And I said, he's all coked up in some paranoia haze. He became convinced that John and Alberto were DEA agents in disguise. And he ordered them to be grabbed. John and Alberto were forced into the back room of the restaurant near the kitchen area. John was pistol whipped so hard that part of the gun broke.
Ooh.
And you know who's in charge of getting information from them?
El Chapo.
He started interrogating them and he stabbed them over and over again with an ice pick.
An ice pick?
Because he didn't want to kill them. He wanted to get information.
Oh my God.
Then some of the other henchmen grabbed ice picks. They would take turns torturing them with the ice pick and telling them they needed to admit that they were DEA or police or whatever they were allegedly supposed to be.
John's like, dude, I'm writing a book.
Yeah.
Right? How sad.
After a few hours of torture, one of the Americans admitted, quote unquote, to being an undercover police officer, which of course he wasn't. But once he admitted that, the torture ended. Next, men were brought to an isolated area outside of Guadalajara called Primavera Forest, or Park. I've seen it other places. That area is described as a wilderness area of pine and oak woodland with hot water rivers, nature trails, and thermal spas. I Googled that.
Sounds lovely.
That is also the home of where clandestine cartel graveyards were.
Oh, man.
So the two men are brought there, and they're still alive, but they are in really rough shape. When they get there, El Chapo takes a knife to John's throat, and he cuts him to the point where he's almost decapitated. He doesn't slice Alberto's throat. Instead, he has him wrapped in plastic and buried alive.
Oh, that's terrible.
In the forest. The bodies wouldn't be discovered for months until one of their killers, Vasquez Velasco, was caught and eventually led authorities to their bodies. The cartel kept killing Americans, but it was DEA blood that they were really after. And someone informed them that the man they were looking for was Kiki Camarena, and he quickly climbed to the top of their hit list. They began following him. He was always followed by cartel. It didn't really seem to bother him. They even pulled up to Mika when she was driving and stared her down. Mika and Kiki knew their welcome in Guadalajara was running thin, and Kiki accepted an assignment in San Diego. He was set to transfer at the end of February 1985. But the drug cartel, they started planning for his murder, and he would be dead before he ever got a chance to leave Guadalajara. On February 7th, a week after John and Alberto's murder, Kiki's kidnapping was set in motion. Per his usual routine, Kiki went to do some paperwork at his office at the American Consulate in Guadalajara. While he was there, he called Mika, and he asked her if she wanted to meet him at her favorite restaurant. It was called the Camelot, for a lunch date. A little after 2 p.m., he quit his paperwork, and he got ready to leave to go meet Mika, because she agreed, yeah, let's go have some lunch. As he went to leave, he walked past one of his fellow coworkers, and he told the coworker, if Mika calls, let her know that I'm running late, but I'm on my way to go meet her. He walked out of the consulate, and he started heading towards his white pickup truck, which was parked two blocks away. On his way to his truck, a caravan of vehicles approached him with five men in each one. There were about four to five cars.
Damn.
They're not playing around. A man in a black Mercury Grand Marquis. He flashed his DFS intelligence credentials, telling Kiki that the commander wanted to see him. Kiki tells the guy, okay, that's fine, but I need to go back and let my supervisor know that's our protocol, that I have a meeting. Kiki, again, he liked to follow the rules. Then one of the men brandished a gun and put it towards his ribs and shoved him in the backseat of a Volkswagen. To signal that he was captured, another man got on the radio and said, quote, the doctor has the package, end quote. They pulled Kiki's coat over his head and drove to Rafael Caro Quintero's house at 881 Lope de Vega Street. It's a very famous house now. 881 Lope de Vega. The house there is a large home. It's located in the western section of Guadalajara. this home has exactly what you would expect a drug kingpin's home to have. It's got the tennis courts, a swimming pool. It's very large. It's got a guest house. It's got a covered patio. And there's a large wall that surrounds the entire property to ensure that they have all the privacy they need. As soon as Kiki arrives, he's taken to the guest house. That guest house has a maid's room, and then it's got another bedroom, and it's got a bathroom, but it's kind of small. It's located near the pool. In the main house, there are estimated between 50 to 60 men. They're drinking, they're doing some drugs. Many of them are Mexican police.
Oh boy.
Mexican military, government officials, other drug lords.
Everybody's having a good old time.
They are celebrating.
Damn.
Not long after Kiki's capture, the interrogation and the torture began. But before I get to that, we're going to take a break. Kiki wasn't the only one the cartel was after that day. Pilot Alfredo Zavala, you know, he'd been working with Kiki doing the aerial surveillance. He arrived at the Guadalajara airport that day at about 4:30. He'd been doing some business in Durango City. After his plane landed, he and two other men were picked up by a secretary. Her name was Marcela Vega. She offered to take Alfredo home along with the other men. Together, they hopped in the car, they got on the freeway, and as they were driving very close to the airport, a car approached them with two masked men holding machine guns and ordered Marcela to pull over.
How terrifying.
Especially considering one of the men was El Chapo.
Oh my God.
Nightmare. That's total. The stuff of nightmares.
Yes.
When they pulled over, they forced Alfredo into their car by name, and they took Marcela's keys. Now, Alfredo, too, was taken to 881 Lope de Vega house, where he awaited torture and eventual death. In the guest house, Kiki was stripped of all of his clothing except his underwear, and then they began beating him and interrogating him. They set up a tape recorder to tape the interrogation, but during the beatings, they would shut the tape recorder off. Kiki told a henchman that he was more valuable to the cartel alive than dead and asked if he could speak with Rafael Caro Quintero. So Rafael comes into the bedroom where Kiki is being held. He grabs him by the hair and he throws Kiki to the ground. He beat Kiki with his fists. And then he's just such an asshole. He takes powder from an AK-47 and he throws it on Kiki's face and he lights the gunpowder on fire.
Oh.
He cut the cords from the window blinds and had his men tie Kiki up. Rafael was really the most aggressive of the kingpins. He asked Kiki why Kiki took his money that he'd given him for a bribe, but then went ahead and busted Rancho Buffalo. Kiki didn't take his money. The cartel had given money to a DEA agent and told him to spread the wealth with the other DEA agents, but Kiki had refused to take the money. But Rafael didn't know that. And Kiki told him, I didn't take your money. Rafael didn't believe him and beat him some more. They used a tire iron to beat him.
Ooh.
They hit him again and again, and they ask him, do you want to die? And he responds, quote, no, I have children, end quote. They ask him a lot more questions. And during the interrogation and the torture, as I said, I read the transcripts. He's so polite still. He answers, no, sir. Yes, sir. He says, you know, may I please have... And it's just really shocking to me because I would have a whole bunch of fuck yous coming out of my mouth. They beat him more and more. Hours go by. Kiki's ordered to stand up, but he can't because he's just too weak. So the interrogators and the henchmen, they stand him up to torture him some more. Now, remember, we have three drug lords in Guadalajara. We have Rafael Caro Quintero, Ernesto Fonseca, and Miguel Felix. Those are the drug lords. And we have the three police officers that give us the information. Rene Lopez, Jorge Godoy, and Ramon Lira. Okay. So the state police, those last three men, they saw a lot of this. That's how we know.
Are they still like the bodyguards?
Yes.
Are they still in that role?
Yes. They're still in the role as bodyguards, and they saw a lot of this, and that's how we know a lot of this, plus the tapes. According to those three, They said something was inserted in Kiki's rectum. Mm. Kiki's being yelled at. He's told he's stupid. And he pleads, quote, "No, no, sir. I can't stand this. I have no reason to lie. Perhaps I didn't explain myself right, sir." End quote. Then the commander of DFS, the Central Intelligence Agency, enters the room and begins questioning Kiki. The governor of Jalisco State and the Mexican Secretary of Interior, they sat near the door to the room on the outside so they could hear what Kiki was saying better.
The corruption runs deep.
Deep.
Everybody.
Then it gets worse. Max Gomez, whose real name is Felix Rodriguez from the CIA, he comes in.
Like American CIA?
Yes, American CIA.
Oh my God.
The Iran-Contra.
Oh my God.
He's part of it. He asks Kiki what he knows about the involvement with the CIA and the DEA in the cocaine trafficking at that Veracruz ranch. I don't think I told you about the Veracruz ranch.
I don't think so. It's not ringing a bell.
You see, the drug lord Ernesto, he had a secret ranch hidden deep in Veracruz, Mexico, which Kiki had just learned about. And we know this for a fact because it's in the torture transcripts that this all really took place. At the Veracruz ranch, they had the anti-communist, follow me on this, okay?
Okay.
Rebel forces known as the Contras, who were trying to overtake Nicaragua to spread democracy, they were training at that ranch.
Wow.
Who do you think was funding this training?
Was it the U.S. government?
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up.
And how do you think they got the money?
Damn.
Oh, I've got more to support this. I mean, the question is, why would the cartel have anything to do with training Contras on their ranch to take over Nicaragua?
Yeah, why would they care?
Doesn't make sense, right?
Right.
But it does when you hear this. The U.S. government was funding these rebel forces. They were providing them with training and guns and money because they wanted Nicaragua to be a democracy. The Congress and the Senate held these meetings and at some point decided to cut off the funding to the Contras because they're like guerrilla warfare. This was a big problem for some of the top officials in the U.S. government. They needed to find a back channel to support the Contras. So they came up with these covert operations in which they worked with the cartel under the radar. They supplied them with guns in exchange for cash, and they also participated in the cocaine trafficking, which was taking place at the Veracruz ranch. Kiki had discovered the training of the Contras in Veracruz, and he was only a short step away from discovering the entire truth of the U.S. government's involvement in this. But I don't think he got there yet. But if he knew about that ranch, it would just be a matter of time. Kiki's continued to be beaten, kicked, his chest is stomped on, and they tell him if he provides false information, they're going to wipe him off the map. His 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th ribs are broken, and he says, "Don't hurt me anymore, please." They promise him they won't, and he begs them again, "Please stop hurting me. Could I ask you to have my ribs bandaged, please?" That's a quote. Kiki starts falling in and out of consciousness, and they promise him they will bring him a doctor within an hour to take care of him if he cooperates with them. He asks if he can move himself around a little bit to make himself more comfortable, and they say, "Sure, you can," but he's tied up, sitting on a chair. They then smash his jaw.
Ooh.
His breathing is becoming harder, and it's more difficult for him to talk. Ernesto wants Kiki to be taken to the hospital and treated. He doesn't want a dead DEA agent's blood in his hands. So this is where some of the story gets a little confusing. I'm not sure if all of them believed when they kidnapped Kiki it was a murder plot as much as kidnapping and interrogation. At least according to Ernesto, he didn't want Kiki dead. Ernesto and Rafael argue back and forth about whether Kiki should be taken to the hospital or not. And in the end, Rafael wins. He insists instead he'll call two doctors to come to the house. One of them is Dr. Humberto Alvarez Machine. He's a gynecologist who's helped the drug cartel before on multiple occasions. Instead of taking care of Kiki, he injects lidocaine into Kiki's heart to keep him from passing out.
Oh my God.
When lidocaine is injected into the heart, it serves as a rhythmic stabilizer to help keep your heart rate the same. It also makes it so he doesn't pass out.
That's terrible.
So now he can be awake while they continue to interrogate him. Some articles have reported that parts of Kiki's skin on his legs and arms were removed while he was alive. I couldn't confirm that, but I can tell you that on the autopsy, it does show that he is missing some skin on his arms and legs. But whether it was removed while he was alive or not, I don't know. As I said, the torture continues for hours and hours, but not just for Kiki. Alfredo went through the same pain and the same suffering, but I don't think his was recorded because there's no information about any recordings of his. In the end, the recorded tapes show that Kiki can barely speak. His voice is low, it's mumbling, and they get out a drill.
Oh, don't, no, don't, please don't, no.
I have to. They get out a drill, and they place the drill against Kiki's head, and they put the drill bit into his brain and move it around a little bit while he's still alive.
Oh my God.
And this is verified by the autopsy, which shows beveling on the outside of the skull and in the brain. In the end, Kiki's skull was crushed after 36 hours of torture, and that led to his death.
That's what caused his death.
Yes.
Jesus.
When Kiki was dead, they wrapped his body in a body bag, some plastic. Alfredo was wrapped in plastic too, but when they wrapped him up, he was still alive.
Oh my God.
Both men were brought to the same park as the Jehovah Witnesses, where they were buried, and they were buried there too. Alfredo was buried, as I said, alive. Rafael Caro Quintero was thrilled Kiki was dead, but his partners, Ernesto and Miguel, they were not thrilled, especially, as I said, Ernesto, he had wanted him to go to the hospital. Ernesto knew that a dead DEA agent wasn't going to sit well with the United States, and he was right. But it wasn't until the day after Mika was supposed to meet Kiki for lunch that she realized something bad had happened to him. When Kiki didn't show up to the Camelot restaurant, Mika assumed something important happened with his job because it wasn't, obviously, he's a DEA agent. It wouldn't be the first time that he missed meeting her or being at home when he was supposed to. It wasn't until the next morning when he still wasn't home that she became really worried, and she got this sick feeling in her heart. She called the DEA office and was told that the last time anyone saw him, he was on his way to meet with her. That's when everyone realized that Kiki Camarena had been kidnapped, and the U.S. government was pissed. They immediately launched what was called Operation Leyenda, which means Operation Legend, which resulted in the largest DEA homicide investigation ever undertaken by the U.S. A special unit was dispatched to coordinate the investigation with Mexico. And Mexico was less than cooperative in their efforts to help the U.S.
The U.S. is going to find out that they've been involved in it.
Exactly. So the U.S. government did something unprecedented. They closed the entire border leading in and out of Mexico. This may not seem like a big deal. We're always talking about closing borders and stuff now, but it was a real big deal to Mexico because they relied on these exports for their economy. They had no other choice but to start working with the U.S. and help find Agent Camarena and Captain Alfredo Zavalar. After a few days, Mexico told the U.S., guess what? We have some suspects. We've got this guy named Miguel and his two close associates, Ernesto and Rafael. Maybe they did it. On February 17th, over 20 DEA agents and the Mexican federal police found Rafael at the Guadalajara airport trying to flee to Costa Rica on his private Falcon jet because there was now a warrant for his arrest. The commander of the Mexican federal police, his name was Armando Pavan Reyes, he went on the tarmac and he approached Rafael. And you have to picture this. There are a whole bunch of men in wearing bulletproof vests with guns out. So this commander, he goes up to Rafael and everybody's watching. When he goes up to him, he gives Rafael a hug. And the two talk for a few minutes. Then Rafael boards the plane and everybody's just watching going like, what
the hell?
What the hell? They all stared in awe. Rafael grabs a bottle of champagne and yells out, bring better guns next time. The door closes and the plane takes off. The commander tells the DEA and the Mexican police that that was not Rafael. That was a friend of his. And they had bad information. But people noticed he got an envelope.
Oh, boy.
And in that envelope was 60 million pesos.
So how much is 60 million pesos?
I think by today's standards, that'd be like $3 million.
Holy shit. An envelope? Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
It had an actual, it was written out.
Really?
Yeah. I saw it. It looked like a check, pretty much.
Okay. So it wasn't like a fat stack of cash.
No, it wasn't cash. You can Google it. You can see what he got.
Wow.
So the FBI knows who they're looking for, but they still haven't found Kiki and Alfredo. They don't even know if they're alive or dead. According to the FBI law bulletin that was released in 1989, this is where I'm getting this information from. The U.S. and high-ranking Mexican officials were really turning up the heat to find out what happened to Alfredo and Kiki and punish those involved. Of course, there's a big problem with this. As we said earlier, some of those high-ranking officials were part of the kidnapping plot, and they didn't want to get caught. So members of the Guadalajara drug cartel and certain Mexican law enforcement officials came up with this plan to make sure they didn't get implicated in the crime. They were going to set up a rival drug ring called Bravo, who would be held responsible for the kidnapping and, of course, the murders. The plan went like this, so follow this, okay? The Mexican federal police would claim to have received an anonymous letter that stated Kiki and Alfredo were being held at the Bravo drug gang's ranch in La Angostura, Michoacán. Sorry, I'm sure I'm slaughtering it, which is about 60 miles southeast of Guadalajara. The Mexican police were going to raid that ranch, kill all the workers, and then stumble upon the graves of Kiki and Alfredo. Then they'd call up the DEA. The DEA would come in and they'd say, hey, look it, it's the Bravos. They did that. And that would be the end.
Brilliant.
Sounds good, right? But it didn't work out that way.
You don't say.
In March, the Mexican police raided the Bravo ranch. And they did. They killed all the Bravo gang members, along with one Mexican officer died.
Collateral damage.
I was just going to say that. But everything didn't go according to plan. The Mexican federal police called the DEA and they said, yeah, we found this grave site. It's Kiki and Alfredo. You need to come here. The problem was when they made that call, there was no grave. The men who were paid to dig a grave and rebury Kiki and Alfredo in it instead dumped the bodies on the side of the road near the ranch.
Oh, my God.
So the DEA arrived immediately on the scene, and the Mexican police didn't have time to fix their mistake.
Oh, shit.
And the DEA is like, wait a second here. Told us there's this grave. It doesn't make sense. That's when the heat got really turned up by the U.S. I mean, the pressure on the Mexican government was enormous. It was clear to everybody involved that the Mexican government was involved. They also noticed that where the bodies were, there was no bodily fluid in the dirt and the soil. And the soil on the body bags, the plastic, didn't match the soil on the ground where they were. So they knew that they had been buried somewhere else and then dug up. This resulted in a huge FBI investigation. And local authorities just kept pushing back. They delayed the FBI from autopsying the bodies. They insisted that they had to autopsy the bodies first. The Mexican federal police promised to do an internal investigation, and that resulted in the firing of Commander Pavon Reyes, the guy who took the bribe, and the director of Mexican's Interpol, the actual director of Mexican's Interpol.
It's crazy how deep it goes.
A month later, the FBI got a tip that led them to the Grand Marquis that was used in the kidnapping. And this stuff, it's seriously, I know why Netflix made Narcos, because this stuff is for the movies. The car was found at a Ford dealership owned by Rafael. They had built a wall around the car to conceal it.
Oh, that's great.
Why not just burn the car?
Right.
They built a wall around it. I can't make this shit up.
No one will find it.
Also in April, the FBI learned about the house at 881 Lope de Vega. But the FBI wasn't allowed to process the crime scene until the Mexican federal police processed and removed anything they deemed to be pertinent evidence. Mm. So the FBI gets the scraps. When the FBI was finally allowed in, they were informed before they even started, that the house had been cleaned, repainted since the murders, and that some Mexican federal police had been living in the house the past month.
Wow.
Obviously, the scene had been tainted. The FBI investigators immediately focused on the guest house. And this is where the guest house becomes very unusual. The door to the bedroom that Kiki was in was made of steel and had reinforced iron bars.
Again, that's not obvious.
That's not standard guest house doors either. Both rooms in that guest house were processed for hair and fingerprint evidence. In the garage was a Volkswagen Atlantic, and one of the hairs found in that car was a hair from Kiki that had been pulled out. They could tell it was pulled. Now, when one of the agents from the FBI was walking around the tennis court, he spotted something blue out of the corner of his eye in one of the water drains, the little drains. He went inside the main house and he asked one of the Mexican federal police officers for a crowbar. He wanted to open the drain. This got the Mexican police all in a frenzy. Their panties went all in a bunch. Oh, and they refused to give him a crowbar. They went out to the tennis courts, and by the time they got there, though, another FBI agent had managed to take the grate off. When he got the grate off, he found a license plate that was bent in half. The Mexican federal police grabbed the license plate from the agent's hand and refused to give it back. And then they kicked the FBI off the property. But the FBI, at that point, had collected 5 garbage bags full of evidence, because the FBI is badass!
Doesn't matter if you painted over it.
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. They're going to find something.
Something. In June, an associate of Rafael Caro Quintero's was arrested, and he began talking. He led the police to the bodies of the journalist John Walker and his friend Alberto. They were found 200 feet from a forest path in the Primavera Forest or Park, and soil samples from that area matched the soil samples found on Kiki and Alfredo's body. That's how they know that they were originally buried there. 58 days after Kiki and Alfredo's murder, U.S. authorities, with the cooperation of the Mexican and the Costa Rican government, were able to arrest Rafael Caro Quintero, and he was returned to Mexico to face charges for murder. Ernesto knew it was only a matter of time before they came after him, and he began losing his mind.
Oh, he was probably super paranoid.
He was so paranoid and doing drugs. Mm. According to his bodyguard, Jorge Godoy, Ernesto was in possession of Kiki's torture tapes, and he would play them over and over all day long.
Oh my God.
It was some sort of self-punishment. He knew that was the defining moment Kiki's torture that was going to take him down. 3 days after Rafael was arrested, the Mexican government surrounded Ernesto's home. He surrendered and Jorge Godoy was arrested too. But the two other Mexican police officers / bodyguards I told you about, Ramon Lira and Rene Lopez, they managed to escape. The tapes of Kiki's torture were seized at that house in Puerto Vallarta. And a lot of poor officials had to listen to hours and hours of his torture. Although Mexico had arrested Ernesto and Rafael, they refused to extradite them to the U.S.
Really?
Yep. Rafael started talking to authorities because he had a big mouth. He's just an ass. He held a press conference, basically, and he was laughing with the reporters. And he said, I don't even know any DEA agents.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just laughing with this huge grin. It's really sickening. He outed another drug kingpin and one of his good friends. His name was Jesus Felix Gutierrez. Jesus had helped him escape and elude authorities. And I'm only saying this, it's kind of a side note, but it's just like a movie. That's why I had to say it. Jesus, after helping Rafael, he fled to LA, where he had a home and 2 businesses. When he got there, he didn't stay at his home because he was too afraid he'd get caught. He stayed at a Best Western. He was watching the news and he heard Rafael squealing on him.
Oh no.
So to elude authorities, he went and had plastic surgery done.
Did he really?
He specifically had an eye lift and a dimple added to his face. And then he had his tattoos removed. But the authorities still caught up with him. He was tried and convicted for helping Rafael and he got 10 years in the United States. But I'm like, he actually got plastic surgery.
Really? That is right out of a movie.
I know. Meanwhile, the third drug lord, Miguel Felix, he eluded authorities for years. with the help of corrupt Mexican police. The U.S. government really, really wanted to get to the bottom of what happened to Kiki and Alfredo. And they really wanted to know who was completely responsible. They knew it wasn't just these three drug lords. Operation Legend continued on for 2 years, but it stalled out. So the DEA hired a badass DEA agent named Hector Barreras to take over the investigation. And Hector is a badass. He worked for years undercover, taking down the cartel in Mexico. And one of the ways he was so successful is he gained a lot of trust and had a plethora of informants. Hector was able to locate the bodyguards Rene Lopez and Ramon Lira, who, as I said, were on the run. He reached out to them and he said, listen, if you cooperate with me and you can make it across the border, I'll make sure you're safe. They did. And then after they got there, they told him about Jorge Godoy, who ended up serving 3 years for his crimes as being the bodyguard for Ernesto. And I'm sure he did.
I'm sure he did some shit. He just didn't, I'm your bodyguard. Right. No. He probably cleaned up a lot of shit.
Jorge agreed to talk to Hector too. And that's how we learned about all the shit with the CIA agent, Felix Rodriguez, a.k.a. Max Gomez. And they also let Hector know that there was a corrupt DEA agent in that small office in Guadalajara.
Wow.
There were others they named. And the government really wanted to get some of these people, but Mexico would not help arrest these men. So Colonel Oliver North and the deputy director of the DEA, they reached out to Hector and they said, listen, why don't you hire some Mexican bounty hunters to kidnap some of these people for us that are involved in the murders of Kiki and Alfredo? The price was $50,000 for each person on the list to be kidnapped.
Wow.
Plus expenses for each bounty hunter. One of the men on the list that the United States wanted was the doctor, Humberto Alvarez Machain. And they also wanted Rafael's sidekick. His name was Javier Vasquez Velasco. The bounty hunters kidnapped Dr. Machain while he was working at his office. They held him in a hotel for the night. Then they flew a plane into El Paso. They didn't even stop the plane. They threw him out of it, and Hector Barreras was there waiting to arrest him.
Wow.
Mexico was pissed. They issued a warrant for Hector Barreras' arrest, the DEA agent, the guy in charge of Operation Legend. Regardless of Mexico's fury with the U.S., the doctor was tried in the United States for his part in the murder. The only real evidence against him was some eyewitness testimony, and they found fingerprints on five dry cleaning bags inside the Lope de Vega house. So they know that the doctor was in the house, but that doesn't necessarily mean he killed Kiki. Dr. Machain's defense pointed out that none of his fingerprints were found on the syringes at the crime scene, because I guess there were some syringes there. As a result, on a motion from the defense, the judge ruled there was insignificant evidence for a guilty verdict, and the doctor was released. This guy, he's got balls of steel. He gets returned to Mexico, and he files a civil suit against the U.S. at the DEA and the Mexican nationals that kidnapped him, charging a breach in the U.S.-Mexico extradition treaty. But he lost.
I would hope so.
There were four people that were kidnapped by the bounty hunters, and they were tried for the kidnapping of Kiki, and they were found guilty. I'm not going to go through all their names. One was Javier, one was Rafael's right-hand man named Juan, another guy named Juan, and one was the brother-in-law of the former Mexican president.
Wow. The Mexican president.
They all did time in the U.S. Hector Barreras led the investigation for 4 years on Kiki's murder. And that's when he started uncovering more and more links connecting the CIA to drug trafficking. In the documentary, The Last Narc, which is such a good documentary, if you like this stuff, you got to watch The Last Narc. He insinuates that the vice president at the time, George Bush Sr., may have known about the drug cash being used to fund the Contras. I, having once worked in politics and at the government, I can tell you for a fact there's so many things that none of us know about that go on behind the scenes, which is why I got out of politics. Regardless of who knew what when, Hector got demoted and got taken off the investigation. He was also told he should keep his mouth shut if he knew what was good for him, because there was that warrant in Mexico and he wouldn't probably live very long in a Mexican prison. It's only recently that the warrant expired and Hector felt safe enough to come forward and do the documentary and interviews. And he actually backs up what he says with a lot of stuff. In the documentary, it shows a close-up of a letter he got from Colonel Oliver North, in which it states, please burn this letter once it's read.
I was going to say, why is he putting it in writing? Because he was supposed to burn it.
Right. So what became of the three partners that made up the Guadalajara cartel in 1985? I know you want to know.
Of course.
Rafael was sentenced to 40 years by the Mexican courts. However, being a billionaire in a Mexican prison has its perks. His cell was all decked out. Tanya, it was like a little palace. He got whatever he wanted, from women to wine. It was crazy. There were pictures of him smiling. His bed has a canopy over it.
Wow.
He's a princess in prison. In 2013, a three-judge appeals panel in Jalisco overturned his murder conviction on technicality. They said he should have been charged in state court, not Mexican's federal court. And they gave various reasons not to go into it. So he was released.
Oh, wow.
But he's on the FBI's 10 most wanted right now for racketeering and murder. But no one in Mexico seems to know where he is.
Of course not. No.
Nope.
Never seen him.
Don't even. What? Who?
Yeah, maybe he got plastic surgery.
Or maybe some people are protecting him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ernesto Fonseca, he was found guilty of murder by a Mexican court, and he too was sentenced to 40 years in prison. In 2016, he was placed on house arrest due to his declining health and old age, but he is still alive, living in a mansion somewhere.
Unbelievable.
Miguel Felix, I didn't talk that much about him, but don't let my lack of info fool you. He was a big perpetrator in the crime. Under the protection of the Mexican police, he remained free for 4 years after the murder. This can piss you off. He continued to live in Guadalajara, and he often visited the home of the state governor's house. He was a frequent guest there. The state governor said, I didn't know there was a warrant for his arrest.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know.
I didn't know. Nobody told me.
I didn't know he was a criminal.
The memo. Didn't know he was a criminal. He said he was a businessman.
God.
But in 1989, he was arrested and eventually convicted of the murders, and he got sentenced to 37 years in prison. While in prison, he continued to run the drug cartel. He actually had a cell phone before most people and ran it from prison until he got transferred to a maximum security prison.
So is he still in prison?
He is still in prison. He is in a medium security prison in Guadalajara. Dr. Mershine,
mm-hmm.
Do you want to know what happened to him?
Yes.
As you know, he got acquitted in the U.S. He presently owns and runs a taco stand in Mexico and continues to deny his involvement.
A taco stand?
Yes.
That's awesome.
And he said he's very happy.
Well, good for him.
As far as the Guadalajara drug cartel goes, well, as we know, when there is a void, there will always be someone to fill it. Supply, demand. That's when El Chapo took over and ran it until his arrest in 2016. As far as Enrique Camarena's legacy, Time magazine featured him on the cover in 1988. He received numerous awards while he was alive with the DEA, and then he received awards posthumously. He got the Administrator Award of Honor, which is the highest award given by the organization. In 2004, the Enrique S. Camarena Foundation was established in his memory. Now, Mika, she still mourns the loss of her husband and great love. President Reagan called her personally to give his condolences, and I listened to it. I love the Gipper. I just do. I'm sorry. Tanya knows I just love the Gipper. He could not have been involved in this.
He didn't know a thing.
He didn't know a thing.
It's all Ollie North.
Yeah.
Didn't he get pardoned by the Gipper?
I don't know. If he did, the Gipper had a good reason. Anyway, don't go there, Tanya. Kiki's son, Enrique Camarena Jr., he was only 11 when his father was murdered. He went on to become a judge in San Diego. As far as I know, Mika and Enrique's other two sons, they're living a life out of the limelight, and I'm assuming they're respectable, hardworking men like their father. And that's the end of the story. There is so much more out there. If you guys want any more info, you can watch Narcos. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm excited to. And then there's The Last Narc. There's the article Blood on the Corn. There's a lot.
Jeez.
There's so much I didn't touch on.
This was heavy.
Heavy. So thank you guys all for taking the time to listen to us. and to this episode. If you haven't done so already, hit the subscribe button on whatever app you're listening to us on. I want to give a little shout out to Joe, our editor from Clovercrest Media. He does a great job.
Yay, Joe!
And also, you guys can go to our website, TNT Crimes, where I'll post some pictures about this case, and you can learn about our membership. Our membership is awesome. We have a whole bunch of episodes you guys can't access unless you become a member. And it's just a tiny fee, and the money is used to help fund us. And you can go to tntcrimes.com to learn more, or go to patreon.com/tntcrimes. We also have social media. We got a TikTok out there. It's at True Crime Podcast. We've got Instagram
and Facebook. Yeah. At TNT Crimes Podcast.
And there's a Twitter out there too, TNT Crimes.
So check it out.
Check it out. And thank you guys again for listening so much.
Until next time.
Stay safe. Don't kill each other.
Bye.
Bye.